Okay, it's May 2nd, 1999. We're in Kenai interviewing Pat Mullen. First of all, thank you very much for agreeing to the interview. We'd like to get some just background information on you before we start, if that's okay.
That's fine, yeah.
Could you tell us when and where you were born and who your parents and the rest of your family members are?
Sure. And you're welcome, and thank you for asking an interview. I think it's a real honor to be able to do this. The history of the people in the village is important to me. I was born in on November 28, 1946, in the Frognac village. My mom says it was the coldest winter she ever remembers. Water buckets on the stove had ice on them. Dad wasn't at home. I'm the son of Nadia Shertin and Patty Mullen Sr., Pat Mullen Sr. I've got an older brother, David, older sister, Mary, two younger sisters, Linda and Patricia, and two younger brothers, Norman and Michael. And was born in a Frognac village, went to high school in Mount Edgecombe, lived some time in Kodiak and also in Port Wakefield, a crab cannery down in Raspberry Island. And we moved here, my wife and I and our son moved here to Kenai in 1981, and we've been here for 18 years.
So how long did you live in the Frognac?
You know, we talked about that the other day at the house. And we spent a few years in Kodiak when I was, I know I went to fourth grade in Kodiak, and maybe fifth grade, and I was there before I started school, so maybe a total of 10 years in the Frognac, because we lived up in Port Wakefields.
What are your earliest memories of a Frognac?
Earliest memories of a Frognac. There are so many. It's like, where does a person start? You know, it's, I guess the older people, I can remember I was talking with Mom the other day asking who this old lady was that used to sit by the post office that was below Auntie Nettie's. And she'd be sitting there snuffing that new stuff. And I can't remember what her name was. And Mom was amazed that I could remember her because I was so young when that woman died. And that was probably one of my earliest memories of a Frognac, you know, just, I don't know if Mom had carried me over there or if I was in a buggy or if I'd walked over there. I don't have any idea, but I think that's probably one of the earliest memories. And then I think the freedom of being in a village. I was thinking the other day about this statement that Hillary Clinton always uses, it takes a village to raise a child, and I was often wonder if she even knows what she's talking about or can feel what she means. Because I can remember, if you know, even if 3 or 4 or 5 years old, go running out of the yard and get to playing around the creek, somebody would come by and say, hey, Junie, get out of the creek, you're going to fall in or something, you know. And we just got out of the creek. I mean, we listened to them because everybody, any elder was a parent. If I was 5 years old and an 8-year-old told me to get out of the creek, I'd listen because the 8-year-old was older than me, you know. So it did, basically, it took the whole village to raise a child, because after our chores were done, packing wood or packing water or whatever we had to do, rake the yard or clean up, whatever, once the chores were done, you know, we were allowed to go out and play. And basically the whole village was our yard. We could go anywhere. And there was always somebody there to watch us, you know, if I was way down playing with the Olsen boys, you know, and if I was on my way over, maybe Martha Nelson or Willis or somebody would come down and line me out or keep me out of trouble or danger. And I would listen to them, and they wouldn't get a hold of Mom and Dad and say, oh, Junie was a naughty boy. You know, it never got back to the folks. I was just corrected in my behavior or something, and it was let go. So, and we respected the words of everybody. You know, that was one of the neat things about being in the village. If I got in trouble, I wasn't ratted on, basically. You know, nobody knew about it. You know, it was just that I remembered. And I think really the neat thing was the respect that we were taught to have for elders, like I said earlier, whether they were a 2 years older or 50 years older, an elder was always an elder, and we had to respect them, you know. And I can remember in school, sometimes Dad would ask me to take the shotgun to school or a 22 or something, and try to get a duck or a rabbit or something on the way home, and we'd always give it to an elder. You know, if we went out fishing, we'd come home with a bunch of fish, and we'd sometimes never get any for ourselves because we'd give them to elders. If one of the ladies in the village had her husband was sick or something and they couldn't get fish, we'd give it all to them, you know. So it was a real sense of the village taking care of each other. You know, we knew who needed what, you know. It was really a, I think, a fantastic way to be raised with that sense of community.
What is the most pleasant thing you can remember?
The summers. No, I think just childhood, and I shouldn't say summers because winters were so pleasant, but the fondest memories, I think, were the gatherings, like of a birthday party, and I'll just use myself as an example. If it was my birthday, or anybody's birthday, the whole village would be invited. I mean, there'd be, like, Auntie Nettie's family would be over, and Auntie Zenaida's family would be over, and Grandma and Grandpa and all the uncles and everybody. There'd be like 30 or 40 people in the house just celebrating a birthday, and there'd be pirogues and cakes and pies and homemade stuff, and, you know, it was an all-day thing. It wasn't just a piece of pipe and a bunch of gifts and ice cream, and it was over with. It was a big thing. It just a sense of, I think, the sense of family taking care of each other. And, man, the hours on the beach playing boats and the hours spent during the winter. We lived right by a big lake there in Afognak, and skating, and it seemed like everything was fun. Getting ice, we'd go up and chip ice off the lake to make ice cream. You know, we had one of them old hand crank ice cream things. And that was fun. You know, everything seemed like it was fun. There was no pressure. The more I look back on it now, there was no pressure in our life. It was just, well, we need to get water, so we'd go get water. It wasn't, we had to have it done by 1 o'clock. We just had to get it, you know. But that, and being able to spend a lot of time with my dad on the boat, because I know he used to change Norman's diaper on the boat. I mean, he had us on the boat when we were really, really small. So when I was just down in Kodiak, we were talking about that. And some of the boats he had, I was like 5 years old, and I was out alone on the boat with him. So, you know, just all those little memories. And one of the coolest things I think about is when we walked from our house to Back Bay, where we used to keep the boats, we had to pass by this house, Gus Johnson's house. And he had a great big black dog named Hero, and it would start barking at us as soon as it heard us coming. And I was scared to death of that dog. And Dad wouldn't say anything, I wouldn't say anything. He just sensed that I was scared. And he would just take his hand out of his pocket and kind of put it out like that. And I would run up and I would grab his hand, and he would hold on to my hand until we got past that house. And then he'd just let go of me, you know, no words passed. But that memory, just those little kind of precious things like that, you know. But the freedom, just the freedom of being in a village. I mean, it's a freedom you can't find in a city or even in an area like we live here. To go anywhere and not feel like you were trespassing. You were just part of it. You know, that's a feeling that I never have here, even after 18 years, you know.
You mentioned parties. Do you recall dances and people playing music?
In grade school, I can't remember if it was every Friday night or like maybe once a month there would be a dance at the schoolhouse. And let's see, Johnny Pestrikoff would play banjo, Uncle Teddy would play banjo, John Larson, they called him Sut, would play accordion, and a lot of dances, schottisches, polkas, jitterbug, and things like that. And it was a community thing, you know. It was a big community thing. And then also Uncle Andy Shertin and Freddie Pestrikoff and Alvin Nelson also had a band. They were kind of the, I guess, one of the earlier rock groups, you know. I always wish they'd have named them the Real Village People or something, you know, when I think about it. But they were back in the, when Elvis was first popular and stuff, in the early and mid-50s and stuff. But yeah, it was always a big thing. Same with Christmas programs, you know, that was always a big thing. And the Friday night at the school was movie night. They'd get theater or just a projector up in the school rooms, you know, and we'd have movies every Friday night in the school. You know, I don't know what grade I was when it started, but I can remember a lot of that. Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Where did you live in the village? Where was your house located?
The house I was born in was real close to the Russian Orthodox Church. And the last place we lived was right by the cemetery. And that house was, part of it was washed out by the tidal wave. But the interesting thing about the house I was born in, the tidal wave picked it up and turned it in 180-degree or half circle, moved it back about 200 yards, and part of the house was logged. And you could still raise the windows up and down, the old sash windows. So I guess the house I was raised, born in, was probably midway through the village. And the house we last lived in by the cemetery, I think was probably what they would call Aleutown. There was like two sides to the village. And I don't really know where the border was or where the dividing line was.
Do you remember that people paid much attention to the two sides of the village?
Not that I remember, no. I don't remember any conflict or anything like that, like those people over there or these people over here, you know. I think the other end in Aleutown was just, by the time I came into existence, was just a term that had been brought back from maybe early when the village was first developed, you know, where the Aleuts lived on one side and the Russians on the other. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure if that was fact or if it's just something I was told or what, you know, but evidently there may have been, because just the way it was named, you know, Aleutown and the other end. So I don't know. But I didn't see anything, no.
Did you ever hear the village referred to by other names besides Sapognak?
No. Mm-mm.
What do you remember about school?
School was kind of neat. There were two rooms, and I think it was like first to fourth grade in one classroom, and then sixth, seventh, and eighth in the other classroom, and just one teacher for each class. With the recess, and every, I don't know, twice a day. And if you misbehaved, you had to stay after school and clean the chalkboards. And I was a pretty experienced chalkboard cleaner by the time I got out. But there was a lot of one-on-one, and the teachers were real involved with the kids. Especially, I remember Mr. Krager, is I think probably one of my favorite teachers. He was kind of strict, a good disciplinarian, and made us responsible for our actions and stuff. But he got involved, and he taught us to play basketball or football, and he'd get out and teach us to play basketball and things like that. But we'd play lapture, that we call it, the old Aleut baseball and stuff, you know. But it was fun. And, of course, we had to walk back and forth. And the neat thing about it is I'd have to take, sometimes when we needed drinking water, I'd take water buckets to school with me in the morning. And we'd get water from what we called the Aleutown Creek. That creek runs right below the school. And I'd just run down and fill them up with water and carry them home after school. And Bobby Nelson lived right by us, and he would do the same thing. And Arnold Garner lived right next to us, and he would do the same thing, you know. And I was telling Mom and Dad the other day at the house that, you know, packing water was easy for us. It was just like we just did it, you know. We didn't think about it until somebody got a pickup truck, and they could carry water in big 5-gallon buckets and boilers or whatever, you know. And then carrying water got hard. It got real difficult, just like chopping wood. Sometimes I take my wheelbarrow to school, and on the way back home from the school to where we live by the cemetery, I just pick up little pergillas and stuff, driftwood for banya wood, and that got real difficult. It was fun because we'd ride each other around a wheelbarrow and, you know, spend more time playing than picking wood. But that got real difficult once somebody got a pickup truck and they could just get a whole load of, you know, and drive around and stuff. You know, then the wheelbarrow got heavy after the vehicle started showing up.
Is it on? Do you remember any of your other teachers?
Mr. Burrell, just vaguely. They must have been there just when I started school. And Frankie, I think it was Frank Lane and his family. But not really too well for some reason. Burrell's I remember, and Frank Lane. Frank Lane had an airplane, and I remember he had a son named Bobby and a daughter they called Tinker, but I don't really remember. We didn't socialize an awful lot with them. There was a couple teachers. I think Mr. Bryant, I think that was his name, would go out hunting and stuff with some of the guys. But we weren't really that familiar with them. It wasn't like we socialized with them. And I don't know why or what the reason was. One of the reasons too might have been his dad was never home, because he, like a lot of men in the village, he was gone probably 90% of the year, you know, either crab fishing or salmon fishing or out hunting or something. So he wasn't really home. So that may have had a lot to do with, you know, not socializing with the teachers and stuff, but I don't really know why.
What grades did you go to school there in?
I'm sure it was the 6th, 7th, and 8th. Like I said, we lived in Kodiak for a while. And maybe like the 2nd or 3rd grade, and then the last 3 years. I'm not really sure. But I did graduate. Me and Rena Shaw, we were the class of 62 or something. Just two of us graduated from 8th grade.
So how important was the church in village life?
Very. Very. And, you know, kind of the neat thing about this, I think often a lot about this, is the way that I guess back to the main question, it was real important. You know, our family life, the school life, the social functioning of the village revolved around Russian holidays. You know, everything, because there's so many Russian holidays to begin with, you know, everything revolved around what was going on in the Russian Orthodox Church. If there was a Russian holiday, the school was let out. If we were fasting for communion, we weren't served the snacks and stuff in school that we would have normally gotten. And I guess you could just about say that the whole village, or a certain part of it, were more involved in the church than others. Some had more of the belief and the following than others. Some of the village people belonged to we used to call it the Bible chapel, or just the Sunday school. And there was, I think, sometimes some conflicts between the Sunday school and the Russian Orthodox Church too.
Was there a priest there when you were there?
No, Grandpa Shertin, Sergei Shertin Sr., was the village reader, I guess, in the church, and the priests would come from Kodiak. I can barely remember Father Sturmer, because I was an altar boy when I was like 6 or something. We used to live in the church house right there. But the priests would come right from Kodiak. And, you know, in my early childhood, there may have been a priest there. I'm not really sure.
Did you ever meet Father Gerasim, or did he ever come back in your childhood for visits?
I don't remember if I remember ever seeing him, or that the name was mentioned so much that I think I seen him. I don't know if this makes sense, but I know that name was, he was talked about a lot, that name was brought up a lot. So I don't know, maybe I did. It's so fuzzy back there, you know. Like Ed Sargent would say, you're having me dig way back in the file cabinet.
What is the most difficult thing you remember about growing up there?
I think the most difficult thing for me about growing up there was getting out of school and having to go to high school. I don't remember any difficult times growing up there. It wasn't difficult. You know, people say, well, man, how could you have to carry water, chop wood? It wasn't difficult because everybody was doing the same thing. Everybody walked wherever we went. So I don't remember difficult times. They were hard, but they weren't difficult. You know, like having to chop holes in the lake to get to carry water for washing clothes. It was hard, but it wasn't a difficult time because everybody did it, you know. But the most difficult time for me was to have to go to high school. Because, you know, being raised there where, like I said earlier, any occasion, birthday party or anything involved the whole family. My first year in high school, I was like 14 years old. And I spent my first birthday away from home in a dormitory in a boarding school in Mount Edgecombe. And I didn't know anybody. You know, I knew my sister, and I think Helen Noya was there, and Thelma Malutin, but it was so lonesome. I can remember on my birthday in November, I just stood down, went just for a walk by myself, and I just cried and cried and cried because I missed family. Christmas time, I think I went into isolation. I look back now at those years, and it seemed like I got into mischief in school because I was just so lonesome. I can remember standing at the top of these steps and just bawling my eyes out because I just missed everybody at home. That was the only difficult thing about the village, was having to leave it.
Did you get to go home at Christmas time, or are you gone for the whole year?
No, we were gone for the whole year. We'd fly Kodiak to Anchorage, and then Juneau, and then to Sitka or Mount Edgecombe. And we got one day off for Christmas, a day off for New Year's, a day off for Easter. And some of the Russian holidays, they would allow us to go to school. So even the Russian Orthodoxy played a part even in high school. We would be let off for like the 4 o'clock service and Good Friday and some of the other Russian holidays. What was the question again? Where were we going?
Can you remember any particular problems that the entire community faced?
Looking back at it now, probably alcohol. One of the bigger ones. I don't ever remember anybody ever having problems with having enough to eat or a warm house or anything because people pitched in. Like, and I'll use myself as an example because I know this to be a fact, but like Julie Kanagan lived right by the school, and Dennis was out fishing like my dad all the time, Dennis Kanagan. So I'd stop, and on the way home from school, I'd stop and carry water for her or chop wood for her or haul wood for her because she didn't have anybody to do it, you know. So it was just like everybody was taken care of. Times might have been difficult, but they weren't really, really... I don't remember anybody having real difficult times, starving or anything like that, you know. But alcohol, I know, was a problem in the village. I didn't see it at the time, but then looking back at it now, I see it as a problem. It had been a problem, and I think that's probably common in just about any village in the state, though, you know.
How about any problems with anyone breaking laws or any rules? Do you recall any ways that they were dealt with?
Not really. Not really. It seemed, I know my dad was pretty instrumental. He was kind of respected, as Grandpa Chertin was. Sergei Chertin was a real respected guy. And I can remember a couple times people coming to Dad to talk to them about the guys, like, I know, I don't even know if I should get into this, and you guys can edit to this if you want, but Auntie Nola would come to the house and say that Uncle Mike was drunk and not coming home, so Dad would just go pick him up by his, throw him over his shoulder and take him home, you know. And I don't remember any like breaking or entering or things like that. I know there was some physical abuse involved with the drinking. You know, I've seen some hellacious fights, you know, involved with the alcohol and stuff, but it was like, oh, they'll just work it out, or oh, they're just drinking and they'll get over it, or it's none of our business was another big one, you know, none of our business. Where now it is our business. If domestic violence is seen, it's a big thing. And then it didn't seem to be. It was just, oh, that's just the way they are, you know. But as far as anything that's bad, but anything as far as breaking or entering or vandalism, I don't ever remember anything like that.
What do you recall about health care and how that was provided?
Health care, I think my mom was a kind of a PA. She could give shots and stuff. I remember that. And also there was one of the missionaries, Barbara Crozier, and there was once in a while a dentist would come over. Oh, I know, there was a big white boat used to come in. I can't remember the name of it. But they would do, I guess it was a BIA ship or something, would just travel throughout the state, hitting all the villages on the coast. But they'd come in and anchor up in front of Valleytown, and I can remember explicitly this one year going out in Uncle Teddy's boat. They'd put all the kids in a skiff and rows out to Uncle Teddy's boat. Then we'd go out in this big white boat. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, and they'd have this ladder, and we'd have to walk up this ladder thing, and we got little checkups and stuff. And then nurses would come too, and I can remember into school. And I don't know where the nurses came from, if they were from the Indian Health Service, BIA, or from the hospital in Kodiak or what, but I can remember they'd take our blood pressure and check our ears, ENT checkup, I guess, and shots, and check our teeth. And they would be, I guess that would be like teeth. I remember having my teeth worked on once in that big boat. And I guess maybe they coordinated between the nurses that came and checked us, and this information might be passed on to the Great White Ship or whatever it was, and we'd be taken care of there. I can't remember the name of it, though. I remember seeing it one time, clearly.
I'm sorry, I can't remember the name either, but it's been mentioned.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Do you ever remember a case where someone was like seriously injured or really seriously ill and they needed to be evacuated? Or
not that I remember. The only two accidents I remember was when my sister was playing on a merry-go-round by Annie Kuhn's house and she smashed into a tree and broke her collarbone. And then I was crawling around someplace where I shouldn't have been and fell down and hit an old bed frame and split my eye open. But Barbara Crozier fixed that. But evacuations, I don't remember. I do remember a helicopter landing on the beach below Auntie Nettie's house. But I don't remember what the reason was for it.
What do you remember about the stores?
The store was a community effort, I remember that, because Uncle Mike's wife owned it, Enola, and she would order freight from Kodiak, and then sometimes one of the boats, whoever was going into Kodiak, would pick up all the freight and then bring it over and we'd row it ashore, or men would row it ashore in the skiffs, and everybody from the village would come down with their wheelbarrows or tachkas and just wheel and carry all the groceries and freight up to the store. And it used to be a big treat because Enola would treat everybody ice cream. Ice cream would come in these big boxes wrapped up in real thick blankets, and she'd break some of them open and everybody'd get an ice cream cone or something, you know, for doing that. But that was a community effort. And it was kind of neat when you guys were coming in. I was going to tell you that Mom, when I was at Mom's house the other day, she pulled out a roll of string that was kind of cone-shaped. And I looked at it and I said, did you get that from Enola's store? Because Enola had this spool of string that went from the counter up through a thing up here and kind of hung down, and when she'd always wrap your stuff in a box and then brown paper and then tie it up with this white string. And it was kind of ironic to go home and then see that little spool of white string that Mom had.
Who do you remember as being the leaders of the village?
I think the elders, like Grandpa Shertine, Old Man Nelson, and then Oscar Peterson. And I was thinking about that the other day, about banya. Have a banya here, and it's like when people come to wash, it's in the banya, don't even come in the house, in the truck and gone. And in Frognac, if there was banya at 5 o'clock, you were over there at noon, and it was a social affair. Everybody showed up, and you sat and drank tea and ate tarts all day. And after I went through a certain age, I had to wash with Mom, you know, so she'd make sure I got washed. And then after a certain age, and I thought this was one of the rites of passage for me, to go from washing banya with Mom and Auntie Nettie and Grandma, whoever, to actually being able to go sit with the men. If I could stand the heat, I'd usually sit by the drain hole on the floor and get some cold air. But it was one of the rites of passage. And the men would talk about where they were going to go fishing, because the village kind of fished together, separately, but they were a group. You know, and they would talk about, Johnny Nelson's building a skiff, we should go help him haul it down, he should be finished, and kind of the politics of the village or who needed help in the village was discussed in the banya by the men folk. Where are we going to fish? Where are the fish coming? Just things like that. It's like that was the office place, the banya.
So there wasn't really a formal like council system for making decisions. It was done more by consensus with a group of men?
I think, yeah, consensus, and then depending on the family, like if, say, there was a death in the family or something, people would go to that house, you know, like the women or the men, and say, well, when are we going to have the funeral? Who's going to dig the grave? Where are they going to be buried? Does the body need to be brought from Kodiak or for wherever? Who's going to build a cross? It was just kind of just decided in a group discussion. It wasn't like there was a mayor and a city council or anything. It was just if something needed to be taken care of, the people just sat down and discussed it, and it was taken care of.
Do you think that was a pretty good system?
I think so. It worked. I don't ever remember any big controversies, you know, no, any arguments or anything like that, or anybody ever being dissatisfied about anything. It seemed like it worked really well.
Mm-hmm. Were you at Mount Edgecombe during the tidal wave in 64?
Yeah. Yes.
Could you tell us about the experience of hearing about it? And
Ooh, boy, that's an emotional part of my life too. It was really scary. It was really scary because Linda and I and Helen and Thelma Malutin, Helen Wise, Helen Noya were there, and the first report we heard of a Frognac was that it was 40 feet underwater, you know, and we thought we were the sole survivors. It was 2 or 3 days before we heard from our parents that everybody was okay. In fact, last time I was in Kodiak, my younger sister gave me a letter, the letter that we got from Mom, the first one after the tidal wave. And she told us which house got washed away and things like that. But it was a very, very scary time for us, and then also for the kids in Chiniga. There was a good friend of mine from Tetitlik village that lost several family members. So it, for us in the coastal area up here, it was a very, very, very scary time for us. It's a lot of crying, a lot of just fear, you know. Like I said, I wasn't the only one that was afraid that I was the only one left, you know. It was real. It was sad. But then to go home after the tidal wave, you know, the goofy intersection by Crafts, you go by Crafts, and then one road goes up the hill, the other one goes out Mill Bay Road, and there's that gas station there. I got home in May of 64, and I was walking up to Bill's and Mary Ferns. They used to live in Aleutian Homes, around by the Shelikoff Lodge somewhere, and I was going across there with my suitcase, and I heard somebody holler, "Hey, Patty, come aboard and have a cup of coffee." And I look, there's old Bill Cuthberg on his power scow, the Salif, the one that's in Whale Pass. It ended up there, right there at that intersection in the gas station parking lot. He still had crab, and they saved the crab and processed it. But yeah, it was real scary, and we didn't get a big effect from the tidal wave down there. The tide came in, and some of the skiffs and stuff broke loose from the harbor, you know, the boat harbor in Sitka, but nothing real bad.
So when did you hear that your family was okay?
Mom got a telegram down to us, I think, like 2 or 3 days after the tidal wave. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'll give you guys that letter, and maybe you could use it in your book. You look at it, you know.
Oh, yeah, we would like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember hearing any stories from elders when you were young, that any ones that particularly stand out?
About shamans, you know, I've heard tales that they were hairy people. And I can remember in school, I don't know how old I was, but like Edwin Nelson and Andy and Jackie Nelson and them went running by the schoolyard. It was recess time, and they said there was a hairy man running up past Grandma's house up to the mountains. So the whole schoolyard went chasing after this hairy creature that was supposed to be swinging through the trees and running and stuff. And I don't remember if my mom told me about the... Oh, no, I'm getting shamans and Olochs mixed up. Olochs were the ones that I'd heard were like Russian sailors or some that had got lost at sea and just gotten a beach somehow and just wandered aimlessly and did whatever they could to survive, not wanting to come in to the Aleut villages because they had mistreated the Aleuts and stuff so much that they chose to just live off by themselves. That's one of the tales I remember hearing about Olochs. And shamans, Johnny Pesterkoff used to tell us a lot of shaman stories, and at times they were these mythical creatures, and at other times they were people, healers, weather predictors and things like that. And other times they were these creatures or that would just scare you, you know, not hurt you, but scare you. Similar, I think, to the mountain people that Denina have. They just creep up on you and scare the heck out of you, but they wouldn't hurt you, you know. But there were a lot of times it seemed like I could sense something around me. If I was out rabbit hunting by myself, I'd be walking through the woods just enjoying myself, and I'd hit a certain spot and I'd get that feeling that I was being watched, and I'd get really, really scared, and then it would pass, you know, because I wasn't afraid to be in the woods by myself. I mean, there's nothing to fear up there, you know, but I would get this feeling that I was being closely, closely, closely watched, and the feeling would get real strong, like something was walking towards me and then moving away. I could feel the fear just coming in and out, you know. And I don't know if this was my little imagination playing games with me after listening to Johnny Pesterkoff, or if it was an actual thing, but I talked with other people about that, and they had experienced the same thing, you know, so I got to believe it wasn't just my imagination. Oh, I know one story I remember Uncle Ralph telling me is that some guys had been either cod fishing or rowing to Yuzinki from Fognak, and they turned over in their skiff and some porpoise pushed them up on the beach from the skiff. And that, I can believe that one too. And there's something else I need to mention before we get way late into life, is the mail system over there. We used to get a mailboat in like once a month. The Shuyak would make its round to the islands, you know, and we would get Christmas catalogs in like July. So we'd order Christmas stuff in July and hope and pray it would be there in December for Christmas. It would take that long because it'd go by boat. Go from Frognac and doodle all the way around the whole island, back into Kodiak, then on another boat all the way down to Seattle, and then Lord knows what happened to our precious little order, penciled in pencil, you know. But I can remember that Christmas would come and we'd be waiting anxiously for that boat to come, waiting for that bent-up brown box with Sears Roebuck written on it. I hope that's ours, you know. And if something didn't fit, there went the process again. Then the airplane started, so it wasn't so bad after that.
Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you might want to share with us?
You know, I thought about this a lot after Shauna called, and there were so many things, but those were kind of the high points. I think a lot about the rites of passage that a young man went through. You know, I don't know too much about the women, but like I mentioned earlier, it was, you know, from washing Banya with mom to washing Banya with the men, from staying home with the older men and the women in the village to getting old enough to go fishing with the men for the summer. And from being just a deckhand pumping the bilge and scrubbing dishes on the and scrubbing the deck, to actually either getting to go into the skiff. There were so many rights, you know, from going out and not having to have a license, you'd get a fishing license. So you made another step towards manhood, going from the little brown hip boots to the black ones with the orange stripes on top, the kingfishers, another step towards manhood. And then from being assistant, or just instead of plunging, actually being able to stack the corks or the web or the lead, you know, another rite of passage. We just had, all of us, you look back at Harold Kewen, Bobby Nelson, Arnold Garner, myself, we all went through these little stages from washing bonnet women to the men, you know. Pretty soon we were running our own skiffs and things like that. And that was another thing. I was in the seventh grade, I think, when Dad got me a little skiff, little five-horse Johnson on it. First I was rowing, and he'd work in the seine in the yard, and he'd say, well, you can row around, but just stay in my sight. I want to be able to look up and see you. So I just row around in front of the village, you know, in the same. He finally got me a little kicker for it. Then I putz around, but I had to stay right where he could look up and see me. But we spent like 90% of our time in the water. And we talked about that the other day, Norman and I, when I was working with him. All the time, hundreds and hundreds of hours in the lakes, in the ocean, not one kid did I ever hear of drowning. Not one accident with any kid climbing trees to the very top to the lake bend. Never an accident in the village. But it was a good life. It was a good life.
Shauna, is there anything that you would like to ask?
Do you have any stories about hunting or fishing or like picking seagull eggs when you were a kid?
I can remember when Dad had the Linda May. I don't know, this must have been in the early 50s, so I was probably 6 or 7 years old. We used to go up with Grandma and Grandpa Cherokee and Uncle Frank, and we'd all load up on the boat. And we used to go to where Settlers Cove is now, where the old Wakefield's canneries and port lines. I can remember we'd go there and put the boat on the beach and copper paint the boat. Then we'd go up to that little island outside Barabra Cove, and we'd pick seagull eggs there. And I can remember the fishing. We'd get we'd go up to Letnik and get reds and stuff. And I was thinking about the gardens. Everybody had gardens in the village, you know. Well, most of the families had a couple major gardens. But I was thinking about how smooth it all worked. In the spring of the year, the men would go out and we'd get loads of kelp for fertilizer. You know, they get the leafy kelp off at low tide. And they'd bring it in and we'd pack it up to gardens in the Silkas, or they would, and then till it into the soil. And then the men would go up to Port Bailey or Yaganik and they'd start working on their seines and getting ready for fishing. Then the women would work in the gardens. And then at the end of the salmon season, in the fall, it would be time to harvest the gardens, so the potatoes and whatever would all be picked up, and the men would take them up to the cellars and store them, you know. And then after that, we'd all go together and go get silvers and work on it as a family. But it seemed like it flowed so smooth. You know, the gardens would be planted before the men left, then fishing would be over, the men would come back, harvest them, put them away, and then we'd all go silver fishing, and we'd dam up. When we did fish with Grandma and Gramp, we'd make a little dam in Allutown Creek and just put all the fish in there. And it would be like Shauna's aunt or Grandma and Grandpa would be over splitting fish, and Mom and Dad and Johnny and, you know, the whole family, the kids, we'd all had chores, you know. We'd be cleaning fish or whatever, you know. It was just a big family thing. And then canning cases and cases, and we'd cook them in big galvanized wash tubs. In fact, I still do ours like that, 8 cases to crack, just in a big old wash tub. But it was a family thing. We'd go out to Molina Beach, and I can remember Grandma baking bread in the beach. She'd dig a hole in the beach and put dough in a coffee can or wrap it up in aluminum foil or something, build a fire over it, and we'd sit there, and they'd boil fish heads and humpies and old coffee cans and stuff right in the beach and sit there and have a picnic. Yeah, it was a family thing. It was just something fun. It wasn't work. It was...
Well, one last question. How did you get your nickname?
Nobody seems to know that. There was another guy in the fog neck, Johnny Larson Jr., and they called him Junie, and I'm Pat Mullen Jr., you know, so I think they just start calling me Junie. And it's kind of neat to hear that, everybody here, and then when I worked up in Prudhoe, it was Pat. And it's kind of neat to go home and say, hey, Junie. You know, I kind of like that. In fact, there's some people here now that call me Junie. I try to hang on to that.
Well, once again, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor.